Grab your favorite mug and fill it up with your favorite blend, because we're getting ready to sit down and talk about Southwest Florida real estate. Cottrell Title and Escrow presents The Closing Experience, real estate talk over a cup of coffee. What are my closing fees going to be? Should I rent or should I finally purchase? Why do I have to send all of these documents to get a mortgage? The real estate process doesn't have to be frustrating. Let our experts at Cottrell Title and Escrow help make buying or selling real estate a dream. Here to answer all of your questions, our host, managing partner of Cottrell Title and Escrow, James Schlimmer.
All right, it's 12 noon. Cottrell Title and Escrow bringing you another lovely webinar here from the great attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers. As you can see here, we've got the lovely Aaron Miller Myers, and we've got Mr. Justin Cottrell. And I love this topic, the topic of the unauthorized practice of law and what can real estate agents do, what can't they do. It almost seems like the whole institution of being a realtor has their design to kind of walk this line and knowing what way to go and what way not to go, and when do you bring the attorney in, and what can you say, what should you email, what should you not email. So the fact that I want to say this is one of the first times, at least that I can know locally, that this has been this topic has been brought up for real estate agents. This is pretty exciting. So with that, I just want to say thank you guys for your time, because it's busy out there. And here you are just trying to make real estate agents better at their jobs.
It's our pleasure.
And thank you, realtors, to attending. Yeah. I really
Aaron
do.
Aaron loves doing this. It's like the best time of her week. She really gets excited for this.
I do.
She's thrilled.
The webinar is
exciting too. I'm sure you can tell. I'm thrilled.
So some quick housekeeping. Yes. Folks are still entering the room right now, but we're going to start right at, obviously, clearly 12, and we want to be done right at 1. Q&A button right at the bottom of the screen. If you have questions, if you have specific examples, please, Justin and Aaron want to hear from you guys. So just use the Q&A button or the website or the chat feature, and we'll get that going. I am going to drop the PowerPoint slides in the chat right now, and I'm going to throw it over to the lovely Aaron Miller Myers, and thank you all for being here.
Good morning. Good morning, and thank you all for being here as well. This is our we're jumping back into actual seminars where we can have slides that are prepared. The last few ones, we were flying by the seat of our pants with the attorney questions and answers, which, of course, Justin shines in because he loves getting your feedback and diving in deep
but
to these Aaron questions.
Aaron loves her slides.
I love the slides.
She really likes PowerPoints, and she really enjoys when I jump around.
I do
all
enjoy
over the PowerPoints and don't stay on topic.
Being in control. So, but we're going to jump right ahead to our topic of use neighbor addenda to avoid
the. Do you need to change that?
I will. Okay. Yes, I will. As you're going to talk about how you don't like the title of my slide. So
I don't like the title of the slide.
So. As he talks about why he doesn't like the title of my slide, I'm going to go ahead and pull up the slide.
Actually, before that, let's talk about this. Why do we even care about this? Why should brokers even care about the unauthorized or unlicensed practice of law here? What are we trying to avoid here? And I think the
biggest, liability, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you could have some issues with the Florida Supreme Court, issuing an order that you stop doing that or whatnot, but that's really not the issue. The bigger issue is liability.
Mm-hmm.
Agents are not authorized. They're not licensed. They don't have that professional designation.
Mm-hmm.
Thus, if they were to give advice that turns out to be bad for their client, that agent and the broker could be liable. So the big issue here is we don't want agents to be liable. We don't want to have you guys dealing with lawsuits, and nor do you guys want to. And it's really hard, too, because agents want to help their clients.
Sure.
Most of the time, they know what the right answer is to help their clients. However, the right answer can often turn to bad results, and when bad results happen, people want to point the finger, blame. And as much as agents want to be that confidant, be that person, be able to help their clients, sometimes you just have to take a step back and say, you know what, this is maybe what I think, but I cannot practice law. You really need to talk to an attorney and hopefully put that in an email in writing so that if ever anybody ever blames you for anything, you can always go back to do something in writing that I told you that I cannot answer this question for you competently, and I told you to speak to an attorney, so you have that in your back pocket at any point. So I think that's just important to point out why we're even talking about that.
And the second part of why we're talking about it in the context of the neighbor addenda is actually so realtors can have less work to do.
Sure.
So it rather than try to practice law without a license by crafting some specific language to fit your client's needs, there are addenda. Our seminar will not cover all of the addenda, but there are addenda that will probably cover most of the scenarios that you and your clients might be in. So without even having to put pen to paper and risk the liability of it being considered the unpermitted, unlicensed practice of law, you are able to provide these forms to your clients. Yep. Now, Justin.
All right. So, yeah. So the now, Justin, this is funny. So the title of the seminar here is the unlicensed practice of law here. And I think I'm kind of nitpicking here, but to be very specific, what agents do every day is the unlicensed practice of law by having a contract that's with pre-filled out forms that you're giving to your client. That is the unlicensed practice of law. It is the practice of law. The agents are not licensed. However, there is the Supreme Court case of, which one is that, Aaron?
Kies. I will get to it on the slides.
The Kies case that we'll get to that specifically had a carve out for real estate agents. We'll go through exactly what that carve out is, but I think it's easier to think all or most of what these agents are doing from a day in and day out standpoint is the unlicensed practice of law. It just hopefully falls under one of these carve outs that is based upon the Supreme Court case, and that's really what we're talking about is whether this does or does not fall under one of these exceptions to the unlicensed practice of law here. So
if you had your way and you were to retitle this webinar, what would you call it?
Now you're putting me on the spot.
Yeah.
The unauthorized, maybe.
Okay.
Can I throw out, because yeah. I where you're going makes so much sense to me, but I feel like most real estate agents are going to be like, unequivocally, 100%, I'm not going to give legal advice. But yet what we hear a lot is, I'm not going to give you any legal advice. And then a buyer would be like, well, but I'm going to get my deposit back, right? And they're going to be like, absolutely, you get your deposit back because of this. And they stepped right into the trap, right? Mm-hmm. So I almost think it's real estate agents unknowingly do it, where I think if you guys providing some clarity or shining a light on, this is how far you can go, which the addenda clearly is going to be a big help.
Well, and I guess to that point, James, it's not just the addenda too. It's to the question of, well, will I get my deposit back? Agents really should never be giving the answer to that. Agents should be saying, well, why don't you look at line whatever of the contract or line whatever the contract says this. And we'll get into this later, that certainly is an agent's able to do without risking liability because nobody knows whether they're going to get their deposit back or not. There could be so mm-hmm. many other circumstances and you're not, authorized to give mm-hmm. that advice. So
I like it.
You like it?
We're good. I do. Yes, I do. Absolutely. I love this. So we're going to talk about the unauthorized practice of law. When I have unlicensed put in your brain, we mean unauthorized because sure. realtors, unless they have a law degree and are licensed to practice law in Florida, they are not licensed, but they could be authorized to fill certain forms related to real estate contracts without a law degree and a law license.
Yep.
We're going to talk about a few of the neighbor addenda. I've categorized them into five rough categories, dealing with inspections and reviews, contingencies, disclosures, pre- and post-closing occupancy, and accepting backup offers. Again, this is not the entire library of the neighbor addenda, but it is some that come up pretty frequently that we can talk about. So, as Justin mentioned, the unauthorized, unlicensed practice of law is prohibited here in Florida. And in most states, I imagine, yep. there are certain things that realtors can do, but you get to a point where if it's researching the title to a property, giving a legal opinion about the results of a transaction, sure. about the title to how certain property is vested, what could happen during a transaction, what might happen during a transaction, those are sort of legal opinions. So we want our realtors to stay away from making those legal, I'm going to call them legal judgment calls.
Sure.
if your client has any questions beyond when you point out the provisions in the contract, where they can find the information of the contract that they have signed or that they are about to sign, if they have any questions about the rights and responsibilities under the contract, then you can refer them to legal counsel. So the purpose of this webinar is to talk about some of the addenda that are available in the NABOR library to talk about some of the scenarios that we find pretty often in our transactions. Yes.
Well, yeah, and I guess to point out, the reason why the addenda works in your favor and or the contract itself, it's because they were drafted by licensed Correct. Attorneys and or groups for agents to be able to use. So you don't need to stand behind the language in there. That language is already been vetted, and mm-hmm. attorneys have written that. So you're not suggesting to use this language. You're suggesting here's a solution that has already been here's a solution to what we want to accomplish. This has already been drafted by attorneys, so we don't need to come up with this language.
Correct. So we know that a non-lawyer may not make any changes to the forms or provide advice on possible courses of action, and the non-lawyer can fill in the blanks on the forms that are provided because they were approved forms either by the Florida Bar or by the Collier Bar Association.
Yep.
So we're going to jump right in to inspection and reviews. We've got, I will have the excerpts of each of the addenda up on slides. And also, as James mentioned in the slide handout, the link, you can pull up our slides and look at the language as we're going through it. So the three inspections and reviews that we're going to talk about are the right to inspect and right to terminate. We're going to talk about a visual inspection by the buyer, and we're going to talk about an insurance and unavailability. It's kind of weird that it's in this section, but I think it makes sense to me. So we're going to jump right into inspections and reviews, the right to inspect and right to terminate. So all of this language that will be on the slides are directly from the addenda by the name in the subtitle. So all of this language is from the right to inspect and right to terminate addendum. I'm not leaving any language out except for buyer, seller, property address, and signature blocks. So we like this addendum, the right to inspect and right to terminate addendum, whether we're on the buyer side or the seller side. Because if a buyer wants to buy a property, they're going to proceed with the transaction. If a buyer is concerned about some items that may not be deemed to be defective under a standard NABOR contract, for example, an old roof, an old hot water heater that is neither leaking nor leaking.
Yeah.
If the roof is technically structurally sound and watertight, but it's just really old, and the buyer wants to be able to inspect and terminate within the inspection period for any reason or no reason, we use the right to inspect and right to terminate addendum. Now, what if you represented a seller? What might you do with respect to this right to inspect and right to terminate addendum? If you were inclined to allow the buyer to have a free look and be able to terminate, what might you do?
Shorten the inspection period.
Probably. Shorten the inspection period. Yep. How would you shorten the inspection period? Where? How?
I think that's a trick question. But so it I is. Guess the inspection period in the NABOR contract mm-hmm. is set with 15 days.
Correct.
We cannot change the terms of any contract whatsoever on there. So we'd have to go to the additional terms, the blanks, because we're, as agents, we are allowed to fill in the blanks. If blanks has additional terms, and under additional terms, I would say that the inspection period.
Capital I, capital P.
Yep. Capital I, inspection period, capital P, inspection period, shall be 5 days, 10 days, whatever that is in there.
After the
effective date.
Yep. Yep. Okay. And if you need that specific sentence, you are welcome to call an attorney and say, listen, my client wants to change the inspection period or change some language. Can you please give me a sentence? And most attorneys around town will give that brief sentence. Now,
do you think it's necessary for an agent to call up an attorney to get that exact language? We're just talking about changing the inspection date from one day to the next. Can they not handle that?
I think most can.
Yep.
Some folks are not comfortable, and they say, I would rather it come from an attorney. Now, if our firm is not representing someone and the client has some very complicated conditional clauses that they want to incorporate in their contract contingency that says, if this, then that, we were not going to just provide that language without actually having a discussion with the client, without being engaged to represent the client. But if it's...
But most of the time, an agent... feel free to call us up and ask us hypothetically, not on this contract. I want to change my inspection period from 15 days to 5 days. Yep. How would you write that in the additional terms? We'd be happy to just give you that language for that.
Yes. So As Justin mentioned, so there's a possibility out there of shortening the inspection period, so to make it potentially more palatable to a seller. Another reason why some folks might want to use the right to inspect and right to terminate addendum is if the buyer has a sensitivity to mold. And they say, I will not purchase this property if there's any kind of mold whatsoever, any level of radon that's in the property, I want the right to be able to walk away. Yep. Also, depending on where your client comes from, this may be a very common thing that is built in, common clause that is built into their contracts if they're, you know, if they're in Chicago or if they're in New York, and they say, well, I have the right to walk away, right? And unless there's an as-is contract, or unless there's the inspection, right to inspect and right to terminate, there is not this built-in, I get to look at the property and terminate for any reason or no reason whatsoever at my sole discretion. So if the buyer does not terminate within the right to inspect and right to terminate addendum, then buyer has waived that right to do so.
And I think you bring up a really good point, like with mold. So if your buyer is, let's just say, very sensitive to mold and wants to get a mold test, you might be so inclined to write in the other provisions, a bunch of language about mold and when they can terminate, when they can't terminate, and all that stuff is so specific and difficult to do. Don't bother with it. Just get a 5-day right of rescission, right to terminate, and get your mold inspection done on day one or day two or whatever you need. So find easier ways as opposed to trying to craft this language specific to whatever you have going on. This right to inspect, right to terminate solves so many of those issues. You can let the agent know that this is their concern, you know, or whatnot. You can communicate those things. But let's just try to find the simplest way to solve issues without trying to get crafty with legalese in writing those things on other terms and provisions.
Yes. Less work, use the addenda. I think we'll talk about that throughout the presentation. Okay. So similarly, we've heard some folks who've said, my client wants to put in an offer on this property. They're in Chicago. They're not going to be able to make it down for a week or two. They want to make their transaction contingent upon a visual inspection. So there is an addendum for that. You do not have to write in other terms and conditions language about the buyer being able to come down and look at the property. Now, I think that a visual inspection is similar to a right to inspect and right to terminate, but it is another avenue if you need a explanation why your buyer needs the right to walk away. You can say, listen, my client is, they want to put in their offer. They're flying down. They need 7 days to be able to get here to visually inspect the property and terminate within that visual inspection period. So again, it's another way to give your client the right to be able to visually inspect the property. Now, would you accept that and the right to inspect and right to terminate?
Oh, they're saying the same thing. Right. Well, it gets another question, too. If you have an as-is contract, why would you even have that?
Correct.
Unless the days – it wouldn't even matter. Whatever the longer one would hold. I don't see any reason to even have that addendum in here. I think that those that can confuse people. Just use the right to inspect, right to terminate, and stick with that. Keep it simple.
I'm fine with that. All right, so let's talk about insurance and availability. And this is NABOR's Legal Resources Committee's response to the conundrum that some buyers find themselves in hurricane season. So if you have a buyer who is under contract and or going to go under contract, let's say, during hurricane season, and they're concerned about being able to bind homeowners insurance or flood insurance because there is a storm in the Gulf. And knock on wood, luckily we haven't had any in our neck of the woods this year, but the buyer's concerned that they may not be able to bind insurance closer to the closing date because there is a hurricane in the cone of uncertainty. This provision, this addendum to contract, allows the buyer to be able to delay the closing date until a date which is not more than 5 days after insurance coverage becomes available. So once they lift the moratorium on binding new policies, buyer can delay the closing date until a date that's not more than 5 days after the moratorium is lifted and insurance coverage becomes available. Again, this is due to an actual or pending or threatened hurricane.
So and the reason we're pointing this out, so ideally this will be incorporated in the new contract changes next year, and this was their Band-Aid,
correct?
Because there is no provision there right now, so
yes.
So we're encouraging agents to use that if they're going under contract during hurricane season.
Correct. Yes. So, but if the insurance coverage is not available for a period of 30 continuous days, then either seller or buyer can terminate the contract. So let's say that there's multiple storms in a row. There's a cone of uncertainty that there is a moratorium on insurance being bound for a period of 30 continuous days. Then either seller or buyer can terminate the contract, which makes sense. So a seller doesn't want to wait forever. All right, let's move on to some contingencies. We're going to talk about the buyer sale of existing property and the appraisal contingency, which are very, I think, very interesting. So we have some clients who might be moving here from elsewhere, from California, from Illinois, from Texas, from New York, and they say, well, I really want to buy this property, but I have to sell my home in New York first.
So this is the one I actually see the most. I see more people put essentially the sale, the contingency for the sale of existing property into other terms and conditions, and they don't realize that this addendum is here, and I've never seen it done well. It's always, you know, this sale sub, you know, this transaction is subject to selling their property at this address.
Sure.
And this is the perfect example of why we should be using the addendum, because it addresses all the things that need to be addressed, which if you just ask me today, if you called me up today and asked me to give you language for a sale of existing property contingency, I would not be able to just sit there and draft up language that's as good as the language in the addendum. So we use the addendum because we've really, it's been very well thought out. It goes over, you know, it covers really all circumstances. And we definitely, anytime that there's an addendum available, use the addendum over trying to get your own language because it's better than what me as an attorney could even come up with by giving me 20 minutes to send you an email of what to use. This stuff is really good. So, I just see this a lot. I don't know. Do you see it a lot?
I do. Yeah. I do. And yes, and that's actually what sort of triggered me to prepare this presentation because I see this and I'm like, this is, well, what we usually see is, you know, this transaction is subject to or contingent upon the sale of buyer's home. And usually, like they usually put a period at the end of that sentence, and that's about it.
Yeah.
And so we say, well, when?
Yeah.
When?
And what does that mean? Like, so, exactly.
Right. So we want to spell out all the party's obligations and the buyer's rights under this addendum. So the buyer's obligations under the contract are contingent upon closing and disbursement of the sale of the buyer's property. And it lists a spot to add where the buyer's property is located. Now, what the addendum also includes, it says, which is presently under contract. Mm-hmm. I have had some realtors say, well, my client's property is not yet under contract, but it is listed in Ohio. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that that language is revised to say if it's not presently under contract, that it's actually listed in Ohio. If you were a seller, would you accept? Would you accept this buyer sale of existing property if it was the property wasn't even listed?
If it wasn't listed or wasn't under contract?
If it wasn't listed.
Oh, definitely. If it wasn't listed.
If it wasn't under contract.
No.
I
just can't imagine why I would do that. Then again, the question comes, you wouldn't suggest though an agent just crossing out the which is presently under contract and writing which is presently listed, would you?
Yeah, I would have an attorney do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's not, you know, that's not going to happen. But we are going to recommend having an attorney do the line through or have the client do it. Listen, the client, buyer, and seller can draft whatever they want, right? The idea is that they're not going to involve you, agent, in the unauthorized practice of law.
But aren't we talking about, we don't want agents changing forms.
Sure.
We think that changing those forms can cause some issues there. I think that.
So you're saying don't even use this form unless your client's north is already under contract.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Can I pose this question to the agents that are part? Because I feel like a lot of times the agents are putting this information in other terms and conditions at the direction of their buyer or seller. I'm so deathly afraid of mold. So to make them feel better, okay, we're going to write this stuff in here. But what you're saying is they're doing that at the expense, walking a very fine line at their peril. Yep. And there's better language here. You're not going to craft it better than what's already been done.
Yeah.
So my question for the group of agents on the phone, and I know we have some brokers on here. Nobody's on the phone, the webinar. Do you find yourself in the position of inputting this information under additional terms just based at their direction and their desires, I guess is the best way to say? Feel free to use the chat. Let us know how you're going, and I'll let you guys know what they say.
Good. Okay. So back to this particular form. If it's just listed, and it's not presently under contract, I don't think that this form should really be used at all. I don't think it should be used at all because there's no contract. There's nothing at that point. You might as well just have an inspection period or right to terminate throughout the whole life of the contract because they're not under any obligation to sell at any point in time. So I think the whole idea is that if the buyer here is already under contract to sell to somebody else, then that's why we have this addendum. If they're not already under contract, then it really turns into a right for this buyer to terminate at any point in time because they don't need to ever sell that property. So that's my concern with that. I would never use this if it was just listed. So that's my answer.
My primary concern is that folks are not reading that line that says which is presently under contract. They're saying if they do use this addendum, they're saying, okay, I've got the buyer sale of existing property. I just look at the blanks, fill in the property address, and fill in a date, and then move about our merry way. So I think it's also good to review the next two paragraphs, which are really important. And the third one, I don't know. I had an attorney on the other side of a transaction who learned of that somewhat recently, that final provision. So, okay. So this buyer sale of existing property contingencies continues to say if the such closing and disbursement on the sale of the buyer's property does not occur on or before blank date, then either seller or buyer may terminate the contract. So let's say your transaction scheduled to close up north today. You're scheduled to close on this new property down here in Florida next week. It does not close today in Ohio. Either your buyer or your seller may terminate the contract. Mm-hmm. Now, if I was a seller, I wouldn't necessarily want to terminate the contract. I might want to be able to, you know, maybe extend this provision or take my chances that the buyer is actually going to be able to close on their property in Ohio this week and close on my purchase next week. But just know that right for the contingent on the buyer's sale of existing property is a right that is extended to the seller and to the buyer. Mm-hmm. So it's not some of our contingencies or buyer may. Sure, right, sure. One way.
Yep.
If the seller receives notice that the buyer has either satisfied or waived the contingencies, so let's say I had until today to close on my Ohio property, but I actually closed it last week, I provide this written notice to the seller, then our contingency, we're continuing forward with this transaction. Sure. So my seller no longer has the right to terminate the contract under this contingency because I've provided them notice either that my sale of the Ohio property has closed or that I waive this actual contingency. How would you waive? What would you do to be able to provide a waiver? There's no NAVOR form for a waiver for this.
This is interesting because we're going to talk about unlicensed practice of law, but I do think just the agent advising that the seller hereby waives.
The buyer.
Buyer hereby waives it. Yep.
Okay. I would even say take the agent out of it. Buyer. Agent, say, buyer, send me an email. Yep. Let me know that you're waiving and then pass that along.
Yep.
Okay. So let's say the buyer's property sells today. Today was our date. We say that it sells today. What does this last paragraph say? It says the seller is not obligated to close on the sale of the property, the one in Florida, fewer than 15 days after the date the buyer gives notice to seller of satisfaction or waiver of this contingency. So this can push out your closing date. This will push out your closing date unless the parties agree subsequently by amendment to contract that buyer and seller, I've waived or satisfied the sale of my existing property. We're agreeing to move forward and let's go ahead and reset our closing date. Otherwise, the seller can wait those 15 days after receipt of notice that either I've waived the contingency or I've satisfied the contingency by selling my Ohio home. And the purpose of that is so that we don't have a seller with a moving van loaded up 2 days after this contingency period ends expecting to close, or a buyer that's expecting to move in and the seller's like, well, I didn't even know if your Ohio home sold yet. So the idea is, again, that your seller's not obligated to close sooner than 15 days after the buyer provides this notice to the seller of the sale of their home in Ohio.
Yeah, no, and to me that makes sense. Well, I would have just left that blank so that the parties can fill that in there, that mm-hmm. number. But it makes sense that the seller can't wait to the day of closing to know whether buyer is going to close or not, because he's waiting on just from a logistics standpoint. So I think that makes sense. Again, 15 days, I'm not sure that number is correct. I think the part, it would make more sense if the parties
were able to negotiate that.
Yep. Agreed upon that.
Right. But either way, buyer can't force the seller to close sooner than 15 days unless the buyer and seller agree in amendment to contract that the closing date shall be on X date.
Absolutely.
And there is an amendment to contract under NABOR that deals solely with the closing date. So you don't have to create the amendment. It is closing date shall be X. All right, let's move on. All right, the appraisal contingency. I think this is a really interesting one. So the NABOR and the Far Bar appraisal contingencies are different. We're just focusing on NABOR here. So this contract is contingent for blank days. So here they do give you a blank. After the effective date upon buyer or buyer's lender obtaining an appraisal of the property, showing a market value of at least the purchase price set forth in the contract. That seems fair. They've got a limited period of time within which they can get the appraisal, and if it's less than the purchase price, then they've got the buyer has to buyer may terminate the contract by providing a written notice to the seller with a copy of the appraisal. This is where it gets really interesting, because if the seller, not later than 5 days after receipt of buyer's termination and copy of the appraisal, says, okay, I will go ahead and reduce my purchase price to the appraised value set forth in the appraisal report. If the seller says they'll reduce the purchase price to the appraised value, then all parties move forward, which is very interesting because the buyer submitted a termination. I think that's very strange. But so to recap, if buyer has an appraisal within the let's say the 15-day appraisal period, they provide written notice to the seller on day 14 that, hey, it appraised $10,000 less than the purchase price. I'm terminating the contract. Here's a copy of the appraisal report. If seller doesn't come back within 5 days and say, okay, I will reduce the purchase price by that $10,000, then the contract is terminated.
Yeah, what's really interesting is, that they're sending the notice of termination.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a notice of termination.
No, it's a notice of a low appraisal.
Notice of intent to terminate unless you reduce unless we amend the contract to reduce the purchase price to the appraisal amount. It's kind of, academic legalese, interesting stuff that we enjoy. But
it really plays to the point though, because I don't think a real estate agent can craft better language than what's here, even though it's sometimes a little ambiguous. But the point is, why would they want to put the time that would go into it try to figure out better language than what already exists, which is the intent of everything we're doing today?
Sure. What I've seen sometimes is that this contract is contingent upon buyer obtaining appraisal within 15 days, period. I'm like, they get an appraisal. That's fine. So this is really interesting. But the good news for the buyer is that if the seller does agree to reduce the purchase price, they can move forward and know that they're not overpaying for the property.
Well, and I think it's fair that you're giving seller, if buyer's saying, I do want this property, but I only want it if it's appraised for what I'm offering you.
Mm-hmm.
It's very fair because you're giving seller the opportunity to reduce it and keep the contract together and hold buyer to the rest of the terms of the contract. So,
yep. And if the buyer doesn't terminate the contract within the appraisal period listed on the top paragraph, then they're waiving the contingency.
Yep.
Now, this is apart and aside from any financing contingency that the buyer might have. So if the property does not appraise at the full purchase price and the buyer is not qualified to obtain financing upon the term set forth in the contract, because of the appraisal.
Sure.
Then that is a separate and distinct right to be able to terminate the contract under the financing contingency.
So theoretically, a contract could have an appraisal contingency.
Yes.
And the appraisal could come back, mm-hmm. and the buyer does not terminate within mm-hmm. that time. Mm-hmm. Thus, they don't have the right to exercise the appraisal contingency. Mm-hmm. However, due to the finance contingency, they're still able to terminate the contract because they're not getting financing.
If the lender denies the loan, correct.
Because of the appraisal.
Correct.
So, yep.
Yep. All right. Let's move on to CDD and MSTU assessments. Okay. The reason I put this in here is because I think it's so much easier for agents to have this information, for listing agents to have this information prior to contract execution, rather than try to track down the folks who manage the CDD or the MSTU while you're in the middle of contract negotiations. So part of the NABOR listing agreement includes an addendum to listing agreement with respect to CDDs and MSTUs. I would very strongly suggest that you use that addendum to get the solicit the information from your seller up front and also be able to verify the information using the list of the CDD managers and the MSTU managers mm-hmm. that are in the list provided by NABOR. So you don't have to go and search for the information. For the most part, the NABOR list is pretty accurate, or you can Google the information for the CDD or the MSTU to be able to get this information at the time of listing, and then when you get it at the time of listing, then you can have this CDD addendum to sales contract, not the CDD addendum to listing contract, but the CDD addendum to the sales contract as part of the disclosures that you upload into MLS. Exactly. Which means when buyer submits their offer and they have signed the seller's disclosure, they signed the HOA disclosure, they've also signed the CDD and MSTU disclosure, you have this information handy. Rather than the buyer submitting a NABOR sales contract and they say, yes, it is subject to a CDD, and then you've got to go find this information, which, based on experience, it can take a while. Sure. Depending on who's organizing or managing the CDD. Some CDD managers are now charging an estoppel fee to provide, incensed. Course. So they're charging an estoppel fee of $150 to provide the information that used to be available on some websites for free. So just know that it is the seller's obligation to provide this information. The reason you want to provide this disclosure information is because the buyer will be assuming any outstanding capital assessment balance at closing. So in the standard NABOR contract, I believe it's paragraph 5, if the box is checked that says that it is subject to a CDD, the provision further goes on to say that if there is an outstanding capital assessment balance, mm-hmm. Buyers shall assume the assessment balance at closing. And if there is an assessment balance, then this CDD MSTU addendum should be attached to the contract so the buyer can know how much exactly they're assuming.
And the idea is get all of this up front, put it on the disclosures, and have it be part of the initial buyer's offer that's already signed so we don't have to go back and forth with that information.
Correct, correct. I have had some agents say, well, isn't this part of the tax bill? The operating and maintenance and the annual assessment is part of the tax bill. But what it doesn't say in the tax bill is how much is still outstanding. For how many years is the property or an owner going to have to pay towards this capital assessment mm-hmm. annual installment? Okay. So that's the information. That's the amount of money that the buyer is going to be assuming at closing. I've had someone else ask, if the CDD addendum is not provided to a buyer, would a buyer have a right to terminate the contract? And that's trickier. I'm going to say no, unless there is a capital assessment balance that the buyer is supposed to assume. The buyer is saying that they're going to assume this $10,000, $15,000. And if the seller knows that they have a capital assessment balance, they don't disclose it to the buyer, then I think you're in Johnson v. Davis territory.
I
think you are at risk of the seller withholding information, right? Not disclosing material information that materially affects the value of the property. I said material twice, but you know what I mean.
Information that can materially affect the value of the property.
And I think $15,000 of something that the seller's property owner is going to have to pay over the years is material.
So I don't know the answer to that. Is the CDD MSTU information on seller's disclosures?
No.
As well?
No.
So that's your point. So if it's not part of addendum, then presumably they would not know that information and it would not have been disclosed.
Correct. That's correct. Yes. So this is the place for disclosure.
The addendum.
Yes. So we don't have to go through the form, but you have a place where you can name the full outstanding balance of the capital assessment, the annual installment payment of the capital assessment, if there is one, because some of them have been paid off. You just have to pay the operating and maintenance assessments. And then you include that information. Same with MSTUs. Here in Collier County, you can go to Collier County Government's website. I can send a link to you guys. You can request the information for the MSTUs for the property. And same, outstanding balance of the capital assessment, annual installments of the capital assessment, and the MSTU operating and maintenance assessment. That information is on the tax bill, just not the outstanding capital balance. Gotcha. And again, I highlighted the buyer has agreed to assume at closing the outstanding capital balances on the CDD or MSTU assessments. All right, lead-based paint. If there is a residential dwelling that was built prior to 1978, a buyer is required to receive this document. This is a federal law. The buyer is required to receive a disclosure. So this lead-based paint addendum is divided into two parts. One is the seller's disclosure, and the other part is the buyer's acknowledgement of receipt of certain information. And the third part, which I did not include, but is the seller, buyer, listing agent, selling agent's obligation to sign this document saying that we think this information is accurate. So, again, there's a lead warning statement. Lead is bad, poses health risks. Seller's disclosure for the real property located at blank, and there's a box for the parties to check. So seller, again, if you've got a property that's listed that was residence was built prior to 1978, have this form completed along with your other addenda that you have. You're going to upload it into MLS so that when the buyer submits their offer, they've already received this warning or this notice. So seller either knows of lead-based paint or hazards that exist in the property, and they explain, or seller has no knowledge of lead-based paint or lead-based paint hazards in the dwelling. So seller has part one, check the box. They either know or they don't know. And number two, records and reports available. Now, if the seller knows, they've probably provided some records or reports relating to lead-based paint on their property. They check the box that they've provided it, or seller has no reports or records relating to lead-based paint. So that top part, seller should have completed, and the buyer completes the second part. So buyer's acknowledgement and rights. So buyer has received copies of all information listed above, if it exists. Buyer has received the pamphlet, Protect Your Family from Lead in Your Home. If you don't have that pamphlet handy in your desktop, I will send a link to you. You can hold on to it in case you have a client who is purchasing property that was built prior to 1978. And the buyer has either received a 10-day opportunity to do a risk assessment, or the buyer has waived the opportunity to conduct a risk assessment. If neither of those boxes are checked, then A will apply. So if this attachment of the lead-based paint addendum is provided prior to the effective date of the sales contract, then standard D2A of the sales contract provides an inspection period that fulfills this requirement. So the buyer can just conduct their lead-based paint assessment during their normal inspection period. If the buyer receives the lead-based paint addendum anytime after the effective date of the sales contract, buyer has a period of 3 days, excluding Saturdays, Sundays, and federal legal holidays, following receipt of the information in items B1, meaning the copy of the information that were listed from the seller's disclosure, B2, meaning the Protect Your Family from Lead in the Home pamphlet, to terminate the sales contract by written notice to seller of such termination. So buyer, again, you want to get this to the buyer prior to contract execution. Otherwise, they have a 3-day right of rescission, similar to what's provided in the condo or the HOA statute. If they don't receive it at the time of contract execution, they've got the right to terminate. If the buyer doesn't terminate the contract, then they'll have a period of 10 days within which to conduct the risk assessment, which is typically the inspection period under the contract. and just the very last part, the following parties have reviewed the information and certified to the best of their knowledge that the information they've provided is true and accurate, and it is signed by the buyer and the seller and the selling agent and the listing agent. So if you are the listing agent and you know that your seller has some information with or reports with respect to lead-based paint, you better make sure that they are provided to the purchaser and the information in this document is accurate. All right. How's our time?
We are doing well. We've got about 16 minutes left till we hit the 1 o'clock, and I'll absolutely use this moment to say thank you, everybody, for joining. You know, Cottrell Title and Escrow's The Closing Experience webinar. You know, the funny thing is that we've got agents live. There's going to be folks listening to podcasts. There's going to be folks watching the video later. We would love the opportunity to earn one deal from you. And I'm just going to leave it at that. We don't like to do a hard sale, but if you're doing a closing in Southwest Florida, we would love the opportunity to show you how good we are at real estate closings. And if this content that you're listening to today is any indication, if you think about how granular we are right now about getting into the nuts and bolts of trying to make real estate agents succeed at what they do, we want to do the same thing with a closing. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you guys so much. And again, the attorneys of Grant Cottrell Miller Myers, Justin Cottrell, and Aaron Miller Myers taking the time to dive in is well appreciated.
Thank you.
Post-closing occupancies.
You could probably keep this really short. You're just going to say, don't do it.
No. So again, back to the whole idea of the unlicensed practice of law. This is just really, really tricky. there's... Florida law has very specific statutes regarding landlord-tenant issues. And I get the need for post-closing occupancies. The idea is that we want to close, but I can't be out for another 3 days because I need to pack stuff up or I need whatever it might be the case. It seems like there's so many times this comes up and it makes sense to do a post-closing occupancy. How NABOR handles this in their addendum here is interesting because they kind of try to, it seems like they're trying to skirt around the whole idea that there's a landlord-tenant relationship here. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm aware, and I don't think there is any case law on this issue, again, we'd only be talking about-
On what issue?
On whether or not there's a landlord-tenant relationship between the buyer and seller who signed this NABOR post-closing occupancy here. Does that create that landlord-tenant relationship, or could it be more of a guest or a licensee type thing where they have their rights as a tenant here? So those are all things that come up. And also there's so many issues with insurance and damages and risk of loss. Mm-hmm. There's just a number of issues that come up. I appreciate what NABOR is doing here. I think it's probably the easiest way to handle it most of the time. However, the FARBAR contract, they reference a lease essentially. So you're actually leasing the property to somebody else pursuant to a full lease with all the terms of a lease. There's a reason, you know, the FARBAR lease is probably 10 pages long. And there's a reason it's 10 pages long is because there's a lot of issues to deal with here. NABOR tried to say, okay, well, we're not going to really treat it as a tenant. We're not going to go down the whole lease. We're going to create this addendum here that gives them so many days to stay beyond. And whether that creates a landlord-tenant relationship or not is really kind of unknown. And then all the other issues that might come up is a little bit unknown. But again, I understand why they're doing it this way. And I don't think it's wrong necessarily. I just, there's so many different unknowns here. And I think that there's real issues with the unlicensed practice of law if you do anything besides deviate from the forms that are here, because a lot of issues can come up. That being said, also, I don't like them. It can cause issues, and I would try to stay away from them. But I understand that there's absolutely times to use it at the end of the day. So that's my spiel on that.
Awesome.
What say you?
I would prefer to avoid them if we can, but the reality is sometimes it's necessary. So maybe a buyer is under a tight timeline to be able to close. They need to maybe their rate lock might expire.
Sure.
Or they have a 1031 and they have got to close the transaction. Sometimes it makes sense. I would suggest if your seller is interested in doing a post-closing occupancy that they discuss with counsel go through the different scenarios. And same with your buyer, if they're willing to allow the seller to remain in the property after closing, have a discussion with an attorney, because it will probably the end of that conversation might end up with the attorney saying, just so you know, this falls outside the scope of landlord-tenant rights, and it is actually carved out in Chapter 83 of the Landlord-Tenant Statute that if, depending on the terms of the sales contract. So you may have to go to court, big scary court, yep, to evict, and not necessarily evict, it's an action for ejectment. So rather than the normal 3-day right to evict that a landlord might have under Chapter 83 of the Florida statutes, that is not a possibility. So it could be incredibly expensive. Now, all of that said, there is this form. We can use this form. There's also another form that Nabor has that talks about a post-closing lease. I did not bring this form up, but we can. It's similar to the FARBAR addendum where you're checking a box saying, yes, the parties will enter into a lease after closing. So there is that option.
Well, and I rarely see it. If you're ever more than a 30-day post-closing occupancy, I suggest using a full lease form on there. And don't use this post-closing occupancy form.
Yep. But we have this addendum, so we're going to talk about it. So post-closing occupancy is for the seller to occupy the property after the closing date. So it's commencing on the closing date and continuing through and including enter the date of the end date of the occupancy. Upon payment to buyer at closing of an occupancy fee of blank dollars for the said period. So you want to make sure that your buyer is being compensated for the not being able to use the property for that period of time. What I would typically suggest is find out what similar homes or similar units would rent for, perhaps on an annual lease, maybe not during season, and have that occupancy fee that's being paid at closing be calculated that way. And then seller shall escrow at closing with the closing agent the sum of X number of dollars as security deposit to assure the seller's performance under the addendum. Now, sometimes sellers will be really upset if they're having to provide a security deposit to lease rent occupy their own property. And they're saying, well, I've maintained this property. It's my home. I'm just selling it because I need the money. Whatever. Why would you think that I would need a security deposit? Because do you think I'm going to trash this property? You just need to explain. If you're the buyer, you want that security deposit to make sure that when they move out or when their movers move them out, that there's not any damage to the property. And again, the parties agree that the post-closing occupancy arrangement is not a lease. And the occupancy fees are not rents, but rather a temporary right of use for consideration to accommodate the seller. Occupancy is limited to blank persons and the following pets. Seller doesn't have the right to make any changes. They can't make any improvements to the property during their occupancy. Their personal property is placed at the seller's risk of loss, so sellers should probably get insurance coverage for their personal property and get liability insurance. And sellers responsible for all utilities during their occupancy period, just as a lessee would. But yes. Okay. The next provision, seller shall, after the occupancy period, surrender the premises to the buyer in the condition required in the contract, which is broom swept with all the seller's personal property out of the property. If the seller fails to vacate, then the seller shall pay to buyer an additional occupancy fee of blank per diem. So again, based on the value of a rental for a monthly, figure out the per diem and insert that. So you're not just pulling numbers out of the sky. You can actually back it up, and that usually makes the parties feel a little bit better. So if the seller continues to occupy for more than 3 days beyond the required vacation date, then the per diem occupancy fee will double. Yikes. Until the seller vacates. And the seller, of course, agrees that the buyer is entitled to recover from the seller's security deposit any unpaid occupancy fees, cost to clean and repair the premises, cost of collection of this money, and seller is generally liable to the buyer if the cost exceeds the security deposit. And, of course, the buyer has that cause of action for ejectment, which is similar to the eviction. But, again, you have to go to big scary court to do that. And this provision will survive closing. This provision is actually going to be modified a tiny bit by Legal Resources Committee, but this is what we have now. So the idea is if seller breaks something, they'll be responsible for fixing it while they're occupying the property, not renting the property. Not dealing with the pre-closing occupancy. How do you, for by a buyer to occupy the property prior to closing, how do you feel about those? Similar?
I get why it happens, and I think there's real reasons why it happens. I would rather stay away from them if you can, but sometimes you can't. So
yeah, All right, moving on to backup offers. So the seller's right to make the backup contract the primary contract. So this is when the buyer and seller enter into a contract, but seller's like, listen, this is a hot market right now. I want to be able to continue to market the property. The first thing an agent's going to say was, but we have to list it as pending or pending with contingencies, so nobody's going to look at it. Maybe, but maybe we are in a very tight market right now. So if a seller is really not sure if this buyer number one is going to be moving forward and they want to have the opportunity to continue to market the property, to show the property, to enter into a contract with a third-party buyer, then this is the addendum for you. So after the backup, so they buyer and seller, buyer number one and seller enter into a sales contract and this addendum is attached. This allows the seller to continue to market the property. And if the seller enters into a backup contract with buyer number two, seller provides a copy of or notifies the buyer of the existence of the backup contract. So seller says, hey, buyer number one, I've got a contract with buyer number two. It's a backup contract. What are we going to do here? Are you going to move forward? So if the buyer elects, buyer number one elects to proceed with the purchase of the property, buyer number one says, okay, I'm going to move forward with this property and deliver an additional deposited escrow in the amount of blank dollars. So buyer number one is having to put more money down or as a deposit mm-hmm. to be able to proceed with this seller. Again, not later than 3 days after receipt of notification of the backup contract. And then buyers deemed to have waived the contingencies, so that assumes that there's a contingency that this is upon. Closing shall occur on a date which is the later of the closing date identified in paragraph 3 of the contract or 45 days after the date of delivery by buyer of the additional deposit. So 45 days is a long time. So if the parties want to amend this addendum, they can, with the assistance of counsel, make a change to this addendum to contract. If the buyer fails to timely notify the seller of buyer's election and deliver the additional deposit, the contract shall automatically terminate. I actually did leave out a provision at the top of that paragraph, so let me pull it back up. Okay, so at the very top of that addendum to contract, it says this contract is contingent upon blank. So buyer and seller, buyer number one and seller enter into a contract. Let's say it's contingent upon
right to inspect,
right to terminate. And seller says, listen, I want to continue to market the property. I don't care. I'm just going to continue to market the property. Let's say we're on day 7. Seller enters into a backup contract with buyer number 2. Seller goes back to buyer number 1, says, listen, I've got a backup offer. This property is going to move quickly. Are you willing to waive the contingency, that right to inspect and right to terminate? You had 15 days. Now you only have 7 days. Are you willing to waive and also put down an additional deposit? How badly do you really want this property, buyer? Okay. There we go. I'm sorry. I should have started with that. Contract is contingent upon something and seller wants to be able to continue to market the property. This is how they can do it. Okay. So we talked about the relationship between seller and buyer number one. This is the addendum to attach to a backup contract, again, between seller and buyer number two. The backup contract is subject to a previously executed and existing sales contract, which is deemed the primary contract. And is contingent upon termination of the primary contract. So again, buyer number two is aware at the very beginning, they entered into a backup contract. They know that their contract is not effective until primary contract terminates. So if the primary contract is terminated, seller gives written notice of termination to buyer, again, buyer number two. And upon receipt by buyer of the primary contract termination notice with buyer number one, the contingency will be satisfied and this backup contract will move into primary position. That makes sense. Seller can't enter into two sales contracts without this language, right? Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that there's a provision that says how buyer number two, how their contract becomes effective, how their effective date is determined. And so, buyer may terminate. So there's a provision that says buyer have not received the primary contract termination notice by 5 p.m. on blank date. Buyer, again, buyer number two, may terminate this backup contract by giving notice to seller at any time prior to receiving primary contract termination notice, meaning buyer number two gets tired of waiting. They see another property that comes up on the market. They're like, you know what? I'm not sure that I think primary contract, buyer number one and seller, they've got a good thing going. They're going to move forward. I want to cut my losses and terminate this contract. They can do that. If no date is inserted above in that provision, the buyer can terminate the contract at any time prior to receipt of the primary contract termination notice. Again, that makes sense. buyer number one and seller are going to move forward, this buyer number two can terminate. And then the new effective date of this backup contract will be the date of the buyer's receipt of the primary contract termination notice, which all makes sense, right? So seller ditches buyer number one. He moves forward with buyer number two. We know that our effective date will be the date that the seller provides notice to buyer, hey, you're in first, you know, you're the primary contract, you're in first position. If the backup contract becomes a primary contract, the buyer may extend the closing date to a date which is not later than 30 days after the new effective date.
All makes sense.
That all makes sense.
We're running out of time. Got 1 minute left.
Well, I don't have anything else. So next week, 2 weeks from now, on November 10th, we're going to talk about homestead and domicile. That is another opportunity for Justin to shine. He's done a number of presentations on homestead and domicile. And as we're getting close to the end of the year, we have clients who are, you know, moving into their new homes. They want to make this property here in Southwest Florida their homestead property. And so Justin's going to talk about how to do that. And
we did have one question.
Yes.
And it said, should a seller agent notify buyers there are backup contracts? My response was, did they mean selling agent, by the way? But just let's go both ways here.
Always,
right?
The listing agreement might say whether you can or cannot. So between the listing agent and, yes, there may be a provision that says, there's a checkbox that says, no, I don't want you to notify folks of other offers. If you're the selling agent, of course you want your, if you find out that there's other offers, then that's part of your negotiation, right? You want to make sure that your client submits the strongest offer that they're comfortable with making.
Perfect.
Cool.
And regardless of the whatever's on that listing agreement, I think if there's an offer that's sent to an agent, if I'm an agent, I'm always sending it to my seller, whether or not they're under contract or not.
No. You always send the offer. I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood the question.
This was specifically, should a seller agent, and I just don't know if they mean listing agent, notify the buyers there are backup contracts. And it's obviously notify their agent there, but
their buyers, or their sellers. Always, if you ever get an offer for the property, whether you're under contract or not, I think you always need to notify your client of that. And then, even if you're already under contract, is that what you're referring to? The checkbox on the
no.
Okay.
It's tough just based on the way the question is asked.
Always notify your client if you have.
Yes, we all agree on that.
There you go.
Absolutely.
Thank you, everybody. I really appreciate it.
All right, everybody, have a great week, and we'll be back next week. And thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, guys. Bye.